Hey there, welcome to the fifth episode of the fourth season of Science and Society. I'm Drew, a med student and CrossFit junkie.
And I'm Liv, a retired beauty queen and biochemistry PhD candidate. We're two nerds on a mission to break down the science around us so you can apply it in your life.
This month, we're bringing on Drs. Neff and Marikis to talk about reproductive toxicology.
Keep listening to learn more about the ins and outs of their field, your environment's role in your fertility, and practical changes everyone can make to minimize exposure to environmental toxins.
Let's get after it! Dr. Allison Neff is currently a postdoctoral research associate working with Dr. Jody Flaws in the Department of Comparative Biosciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Her current research interests are understanding how chemicals found in consumer products can affect female reproductive health and fertility. Dr. Vicky Marikis has two bachelor's degrees in biology and chemistry from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Currently, she's a dual degree DVM PhD candidate at the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. Vicky defended her dissertation this past July and has two more years of veterinary medical school left. After vet school, Vicky will complete a postdoctoral fellowship in preparation for an academic faculty position. Vicky's research interests are in environmental and reproductive toxicology. Her research is driven by the goal to merge the gap between clinical practice and basic science research in reproductive toxicology. Allison and Vicky, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let's kick things off by learning more about you and your impressive bios. So I guess one at a time, can you each briefly tell us a little bit about your personal background, your educational backgrounds, and what brought you to where you are today? Maybe Allison, let's start with you.
Sure. So I grew up in a rather large family. I had six brothers as a child in the Chicagoland area. And so I've been in Illinois my entire life. And when I started undergrad, I was really, really excited about becoming a veterinarian. Like, I'd wanted to do this probably since I was 5 or 6 years old. And so I got through about 3.5 years of a four-year program, kind of preparing myself to go into vet med, and realized, like, oh no, I don't want to do this. I've made a huge mistake. And so I was lucky enough and fortunate enough to have access to undergraduate research, as well as being able to take courses that were designed for graduate students that kind of introduced me or got my feet wet into the field of reproductive physiology, as well as nutrition. And so I ended up going to Southern Illinois University in Carbondale and earning a master's there in physiology. And worked for a couple of years as a research scientist in a lab there. But I really wanted to go back and get my PhD. So I came back up to the University of Illinois. And I worked in a laboratory in the molecular and cellular biology, or School of Molecular and Cellular Biology. And the work there I did was focused primarily on understanding changes that occur in the uterus to facilitate early pregnancy, as well as kind of maintaining overall reproductive health. And so while I was in my PhD program, I had this amazing opportunity to participate in an NIH-sponsored training program. And it was primarily focused on toxicology and how environmental chemicals can affect endocrine functions. And so I was immediately like fascinated and terrified by the idea that chemicals that I can come into contact through, you know, contact with in the environment can, you know, just wreak havoc on so many different physiological systems in our bodies. And so when I finished up my PhD, I knew that I wanted to still pursue toxicology. And so it was very fortuitous that a postdoc position in Dr. Jody Flaws' lab opened up, because she is world-renowned reproductive toxicologist, or she is a world-renowned reproductive toxicologist. And so my experience there has been just amazing. And I've learned so much more than I ever could have thought working with her lab about environmental chemicals and some of the mechanisms involved. And so my work is primarily kind of a merging of toxicology, but also my first love of reproductive physiology and molecular biology. So I work on trying to uncover mechanisms by which these chemicals can cause toxicity in the ovary. So looking at cellular signaling pathways and things like that, and trying to merge the observations we see in vivo with what we see in vitro.
Well, I'm so glad that life sort of seems to have brought you where you were meant to be, despite, this lifetime of thinking you were on one path. It seems like things have really worked out, and I'm so excited to learn more about what that time has taught you. But before we do that, Vicky, if you want to share a little bit more as well, please.
Yeah, definitely. So I grew up in the city of Chicago. I grew up in a big fat Greek family. And I've kind of always just really loved science, like even as a kid, even when like you're not supposed to have like your favorite subject in school isn't supposed to be science. Mine was science. And in the sixth grade, I did a school project on Rachel Carson, who's like a really influential sort of environmental toxicologist. And from then on, it was kind of laser focused. I was really fascinated by this idea that we're exposed to a lot of things, and that the things that we're exposed to in the environment can really affect humans and animals and the environment kind of all in one. And so I kind of just like did a lot of science stuff growing up in school. And then when it was time to choose my major, I always knew that I really loved science, but I didn't want to be a doctor. And so I started school as an engineer, actually. So I did a year of engineering courses because I wanted to do like green building consulting. And then when I got to school, I was like, I really miss my biology classes. So I sat in on like the intro molecular and cellular biology class and like immediately texted my mom and I was like, this is it. This is where I'm supposed to be. So I switched my major and just got really heavily involved in research. I took a lot of actually non-physiology courses in undergrad. I did a lot of like evolution, ecology, biochemistry courses. And my plan was just to do research. I did a lot of research. I worked in a biochemistry lab. And then as I got close to the end of undergrad, I kind of realized a couple things. I realized one, that I really wanted to make sure that the motivation behind my research was always really applications driven. And then the second thing that I realized was that clinicians are really seen as an authority in society, whether they're, veterinary clinicians, human clinicians, whatever it is. And so literally in my last year of undergrad, I decided that I also wanted to go to veterinary school. It was, yeah, a really last minute decision. And I wasn't even sure I was going to get in. I hadn't taken like any of the traditional like pre-med prereqs or anything. But I got in and that's kind of how I'm here today. So I've done the first 2 years of veterinary school and then I kind of took a hiatus from veterinary school to get my PhD in Dr. Jody Flaw's lab. I just signed it in July. And then I have 2 more years of vet school left before I'm hopefully done with the school thing for a long time. But I think that's pretty much everything. Yeah. So in Jody's lab, I actually study a lot of people in Jody's lab study plasticizers. I study a class of pesticides, which are called neonicotinoids. You might have seen them in the news. They're pretty popular for how they've impacted bee colony collapses. But we're finding that they're also having some effects in humans. And so I sort of study how they affect the female reproductive system and specifically the ovaries.
Great. Yeah, it's really interesting how you both had these like kind of last minute changes of course and changes of action to wind up where you're meant to be.
And ironically, in the same place as each other, on top of that.
Absolutely. Gotta stay in your
Yeah.
lane, though, right?
And Liv and I can definitely attest to the fact that it's a long road, and you want to be done with school after this for a while. That being said, we want to now bring the conversation out, kind of starting from the bait, like a little more basics here in terms of fertility versus infertility. We know that it can be something is, black and white, either you are able to reproduce or not, fertile versus infertile. But in reality, like many things in life, it's probably a million shades of gray in between. So could one of you kind of take us through some of like the very basics of fertility, what makes an organism, be it a human or otherwise, be more or less fertile, and what key factors are at play there, whether it be hormonal, structural, etc.
So You're absolutely right. It is a spectrum. And we use the terms fertile versus infertile versus subfertile. And subfertile is basically a term that we use that, you know, you are capable of conceiving and becoming pregnant. But, you know, something may happen along the way and you may lose the pregnancy, or, you know, you may have difficulty kind of maintaining pregnancy and leading to a successful, you know, birth of a baby. And so it really is a spectrum, and there are a lot of different factors that come into play when we think about fertility in humans, right? So it could be, yes, indeed, like you said, structural. So some people may just not have developed the proper structure of the organs of reproduction. So they may have deficiencies or defects in the formation of the ovary or the uterus, or they might even have, you know, problems with how the different organs of the reproductive system, so like the hypothalamus, pituitary, the ovaries and the uterus, can talk to each other. So they may not be communicating and being able to work together to support and maintain pregnancy. A big one is actually hormonal related. So some women or some individuals may not be able to produce adequate amounts of these hormones to not only ovulate, but also to support early pregnancy. And so oftentimes these women will experience early pregnancy loss. But we can also see that, you know, infertility is, or subfertility and infertility are increasing. And it's thought that, you know, it's not just what we were born with or, you know, kind of what we receive genetically for our parents, but also what we encounter in the environment can also be affecting our ability to conceive. And so that's, I think, where the field of reproductive toxicology is really, you know, kind of at the forefront of things, is that we're trying to understand how, you know, our environmental history, how, what we are experiencing throughout our lives can affect our reproductive health when we do decide to have children. So, you know, thinking personally about, you know, when I first started studying reproductive physiology and reproductive toxicology, you know, I started thinking back to, oh my gosh, I used to microwave my lunch in Tupperware, and I used to, you know, like drink plastic, you know, out of plastic bottles that were in hot cars, and, you know, all these things that I'm like, well, these are big no-nos now, but I've been doing it for, you know, like most of my, you know, childhood and early life. And now I'm like, okay, what are the effects that it's going to have on me and my, you know, plans to start a family. And so, yeah, these are things that, you know, we're trying to, with the field of reproductive toxicology, trying to address and trying to understand so that we can advise people moving forward on how to kind of mitigate some of the effects that these chemicals that they're exposed to can have on their fertility.
So I would love to dive into the word environment and kind of what that means to you and what that should mean to the audience kind of moving forward, because it's, I think, a really interesting concept of what our environment means. Because in a really classical sense, right, the environment, just like the world in and of itself, is certainly a huge factor in our lives in so many different ways, in our health, right? Whether we live on a farm in a rural area, or if we live in a city like Chicago, inevitably the air we're breathing, the soil that the crops grow in, and all these sorts of things are going to be very different. But then you also kind of mentioned these sort of small actions that we take are also in a massive way our environment as well. We kind of create environment for ourselves within the environment that we grow up in. So I would love to kind of hear your thoughts on, in the context of your work and kind of in the context of reproductive toxicology, what really is kind of the main concern when it comes to environment? Is it the environment that we grow up in, sort of, you know, kind of on a more macro scale? Or is it the environment that we're creating for ourselves with the decisions that we make about how we heat up our food, what we drink our water out of, what sort of products maybe we're using? What kind of is the environment that in this context is going to matter the most? Or is it, you know, a little bit of both?
So that is a fantastic question. And realistically, I think it's both, because we know from, you know, animal studies that there are developmental windows that are particularly sensitive to exposure. So take, for instance, if So a really good example of this is the use of diethylstilbestrol in women that were pregnant in, I think it was used between like the 1960s and 1970s. But women were given this drug because, and it's a synthetic form of estrogen, and it was given to pregnant women, and it was thought to help improve their chances of maintaining their pregnancy. And so the really just tragic side effect of this was that children, girls that were exposed in utero to DES had an increased incidence of a very specific and somewhat rare form of cervical cancer. These daughters born to the mothers who took DES were also had abnormally formed uteri. So they were not developed to the point where they could support pregnancy. And so the unfortunate reality of these, what they call DES daughters, is that they, because of what they were exposed to in utero while they were, you know, in their mom's uterus, affects their lives, you know, 20, 30 years down the road. And so realistically, yes, there are, you know, important aspects that you are exposed to day to day, your choices and the kinds of personal care products that you use or how you store your food and things like that. But then it's also important to consider what you were exposed to before you were even kind of in existence. And so it's really hard to parse the two apart, like whether one is more important than the other. But I think they both have a very profound impact on your health.
I totally agree with what Allison is saying. And there's something that actually you said that I really liked. You said something about how everyone's exposure or their environment rather is going to be a little different. And that's really true, right? Everybody's environment, whether regardless of where you grew up, where you live, the types of things that you expose yourself to on an everyday basis, it's really hard to sort of say, like, you know, everyone in the environment or like everyone in the United States even is all exposed to this one thing, because the truth of the matter is that there's, you know, our environment is everything that we interact with on an everyday basis, from like our walk that we take from the train to the, you know, to our work buildings, the food that we eat, the materials, the Tupperware that we eat our food out of. And so everybody's environment is actually quite different and quite specific based on just their lifestyle and based on the ways that we can be exposed to things too. I think a lot of times we think about, you know, exposure and we kind of imagine like drinking a mug full of poison, but we can actually really be exposed to things, you know, transdermally. We can inhale toxins. We can also ingest toxins. And so that's kind of another thing that like adds to the matrix of complexity when you're thinking about how each individual interacts with their environment.
And to kind of build on that, there's also a socioeconomic component as well. If you think about, you know, manufacturing plants that, you know, are kind of culprits for producing and releasing, you know, harmful chemicals into the environment, oftentimes the housing, you know, in proximity to these areas are often kind of lower socioeconomic communities. And so you really see a discrepancy in kind of the exposure to different chemicals based on kind of, you know, where you can afford to live, which is really just a very sad observation for this.
Yeah, it really takes something that's a personal health issue and makes it a public health issue too. So there's so many levels to it. And I know Drew was going to ask a question, so I'll let you, before I keep talking, I'll let you ask away.
No, I first wanted to comment on the fact that both the definition of our environment as well as the individuality of it, I'm sure makes for a rather difficult research field.
My thoughts exactly too.
making it incredibly difficult to design and conduct experiments. Though, like you said, Allison, the natural experiments that might happen in these areas near manufacturing plant gets built, X amount of years later, you see lead poisoning or you see cancer rates that are different or higher in the surrounding area than otherwise. That being said, from what you guys have seen either in your own work or from research and reading that you've done about the field in general, what are some things that someone does on a day-to-day basis, and thinking about that part of the environment question now, what are some things that we do on a day-to-day basis that move the needle from fertility to subfertility or infertility, or in the other direction, from subfertility to fertility?
So I think the kind of the most profound changes in fertility are often seen in people that are occupationally exposed. So these individuals tend to have higher exposure levels, prolonged exposure levels. So let's think about pesticides, people who, farmers and harvesters and individuals like that, that are, you know, kind of exposed during these long periods of time throughout the day, or individuals who work in manufacturing plants that are exposed for long periods of time. So they tend to often have kind of the most profound, the highest, the higher or long enduring levels of these chemicals in their body, and tend to have the most profound effects on their health. But for, you know, people that are not occupationally exposed, oftentimes it's, Vicky, do you have anything that you want to add?
Yeah, I can totally add some things. The one thing that I want to say when it comes to fertility and environmental exposures is that it's really hard to say, you know, plus this chemical infertile minus this chemical fertile. It's hard for it to be that like black and white. You know, when we think about pharmaceuticals, for example, we can think about when you take this drug, you have this outcome. And when you stop taking this drug, you have this outcome. But similar to what we were saying earlier, the thing about toxicology that makes it, you know, both interesting and scary is that it's really this culmination of the, like, you know, gene by environment interactions. It's the exposures that we might have had in utero, or, you know, the exposures we had as an adult that might lead to these really small, maybe it's genetic changes, maybe it's changes, you know, at the cellular level. And those are the little things that it's sort of hard to pinpoint and say, like, you know, if you're trying to improve your fertility, don't expose yourself to this or that. It's a little bit more, gray, like you were saying earlier. It's really a gray area. And so I think that the science, though, is pretty strong when it comes to some groups of chemicals, plasticizers being one of them, for example. And I think that's really kind of the easiest one that we can talk about when we talk about, like, taking something away or adding something. It's like really trying to reduce the amount of plastics that we use, which is good for fertility and also good for the environment too. So it's kind of like a two for one. But we know that plasticizers, which are different solvents that are used in plastic products to make the plastic more pliable, can leach out, especially in extreme temperatures. So the example that Allison gave earlier of leaving a water bottle in your car overnight is a really good example of something that, like, I mean, everyone has done, right? But we know that plasticizers can leach out of the water bottle, and we can be exposed in that way.
And what's interesting about the fact that there's so much nuance to kind of understanding what impact this particular decision or this particular chemical can make, the way that there's just so many overlapping decisions, so many overlapping factors, so many things we're exposed to, you can't really sift out, like you said, and say this chemical means this and lack of this chemical means that. So what I've noticed personally, especially I think being a woman on social media, is I've definitely seen an increased number in kind of not conversation, but like posting and commenting about endocrine disruptors and kind of, you know, especially in cosmetic products and personal care products, household cleaning products. And there's a lot of kind of increased interest in paying more attention to those sorts of things. Maybe not across the board, but certainly in, you know, certain groups of people. And while that's obviously a good thing in the sense that people are kind of becoming more aware that it is real and it exists, the idea that a chemical can have, you know, this seemingly small, you know, the seemingly small chemical can have this profound impact on health over time, You know, that's great that people are becoming aware, but I'm sure with all this nuance, it's maybe not as clear cut as, you know, an Instagram post might make it seem. So I would love your thoughts on that sort of train of thought, like the way people can actually make like more informed decisions. Is there a resource that you know of that actually can provide kind of more concrete science-backed information about those sorts of things? Is it even worth, you know, is it worth scanning all your, you know, personal care products on an app and seeing what the, you know, what the ingredient breakdown is? I would love to just kind of know your thoughts on that. I know that's a really big open-ended question, but if you have anything to share on that, I would love to hear it.
So I think that's an excellent question. And I love that. I love to hear, because I am a Luddite and I try to avoid TikTok and Instagram because I am me. But I love the fact that it's becoming more talked about in social media circles, and it's becoming more, a common topic of interest. And so realistically, you can't necessarily control, you know, what chemicals go into what products, but you can make informed choices. And I think being able to make choices about the products you use realistically is like one of the best ways that you can kind of mitigate your exposure. Because, I mean, if you think about in the case of like pollution, you know, there's only so much you personally can do to protect yourself, right? But if you, you know, are able to and want to make a conscientious decision to choose a lotion or hair products that are, you know, phthalate, paraben, bisphenol free, like you have that option if it's, you know, or you have hopefully the ability to choose some products over others. And you're absolutely right. There are apps that you can scan the ingredients and kind of understand more about what you are putting into your body or what you're consuming. And I think those are really powerful because they can help you to make those informed choices. And they're kind of a good way to kind of dip your feet into the science of it, right? Because, you know, when you start going down the rabbit hole of PubMed and trying to read scientific papers, if you don't have a science background, it is overwhelming and it is like reading Latin sometimes. So I think that is a really good way to kind of get you kind of introduced to, you know, the science of it. But if you do want to kind of know more about how these endocrine disrupting chemicals are affecting your body, I would recommend, you know, reading review papers. So these are papers that people will prepare that will just kind of review the current literature in a more superficial manner, kind of making it easier to digest. And so it's more of like a nice overview of the current state of the field rather than the nitty gritty of, you know, each and every individual study performed. So I highly recommend, you know, finding some of those on PubMed or through Google Scholar to help you kind of understand how some of these chemicals may be affecting reproductive health.
So I can just add a really quick thing to that. Unfortunately, I spend way more time than Allison does on social media. And so I can actually shout out like a couple Instagrams. I spend most of my time on Instagram that I really like to use, like as somebody who's in this field, but also somebody who's just like, when I go to the store, I don't have time to like pull up PubMed, right? Because I want to buy a shampoo. And I just simply don't think anybody does. So there's two Instagram accounts that I could shout out. I really like Environmental Toxins Nerd. She is herself a scientist, but her material is really something that like just anybody can totally comprehend and understand. And what I really like about her page is that she's really good about including sources. And so if you read something, you can actually go and you can find the science yourself if you're interested in doing that. I think she does a really great job of like combining the hard science with like the everyday advice. And then there's also Environmental Working Group, which is an organization that is sort of specifically...
Are they the sunscreen review group, or am I totally confusing them with someone else?
So they do sunscreens, but they don't only do sunscreens.
Okay, cool. Awesome.
Yeah. And so I really, those are like kind of the two things that I follow, like on my personal page. And I really like, I think that there, it's like sound science and practical advice.
Well, thank you so much for those recommendations. And as scientists, I think we can all appreciate the ability to read someone's sources, especially in the world of like abundant and boundless information. It's really nice to be able to read something and have, you know, that citation at the end, because it gets a little crazy out there sometimes. So thank you for sharing those. We'll definitely link those in the episode description and whatnot. So thank you.
Yes, much appreciated. Thank you. And all this talk about science, it's got me wanting to learn a little bit more from you guys about some of the mechanisms that underlie the disruption of fertility, whether it, and you know, I don't know the answer here, so I'd love to hear what you guys know regarding the ways in which these different chemicals can disrupt fertility. Is it like a theme? Are there certain pathways that are commonly hit here, or is everything kind of unique? Is it all very different based on what chemical we're talking about?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. And if you think about the different chemicals, they're, you know, the molecules are all very, very different across the board. So if we're talking like what protein or what receptor or whatever they act on, it could be very different, you know, from one chemical to the next. But a lot of them tend to have, you know, the same kind of effects, general effects. So they might reduce the production of steroid hormones from the ovary or from the testis in males. They might target the receptors of the hormones. So they might, you know, impair how these hormones can affect other target tissues like the uterus and mammary glands in women or the prostate in males. One of the common features that we see in with phthalates is we see that there are they can actually target the follicles within the ovary and change the relative proportions of follicle populations within the ovary. And one of the things that that could lead to is kind of an early onset of reproductive aging. So if you think about women as they age, they essentially their egg population goes from abundant to practically nil. And so their fertility drops off as well as their production of steroid hormones. And so typically this, you know, should happen around age of 50, right? But in some women, predominantly smokers, this has been really nicely or really thoroughly correlated with smokers, is that women who smoke tend to enter menopause about 5 to 6 years earlier than women who don't smoke. And if you think about cigarette smoke, it's, you know, a lot of benzopyrenes or formaldehyde and all kinds of nasty stuff in there. And so certain chemicals can be linked to kind of an early onset of menopause as well. So these are kind of some general themes that we see with a lot of different environmental chemicals. In males, you know, it can target sperm production. So you may see a decline in sperm motility or a decrease in the concentration of sperm that are being produced and ejaculated. So different, you know, there are different molecular mechanisms for each chemical, but they all kind of have, they can all kind of fall into certain categories when we think about their endocrine disrupting potential. Hopefully that answered your question. Vicky, if you have any response.
No, I think that was an excellent answer. I was just thinking, when I think about mechanism, right, I think that there's kind of tiers. If we're thinking about one organ and specifically, we can think about taking the ovaries, for example, which is the organism that I study. The ovaries have two major functions, really broadly speaking, right? And that's to produce sex steroid hormones. And then it's the maturation of the oocyte, which happens within a follicle. And so we can categorize a lot of toxins based on whether they interfere with the process of sex steroid hormone synthesis, which is called steroidogenesis, or whether they interact with folliculogenesis, which is like this maturation of the oocyte within a follicle. And then we can even go one level further to really parse out those molecular mechanisms. And something that I really like to remind people when we talk about mechanism is that mechanism of action can be unrelated to mechanism of toxicity. So I work with a class of pesticides called neonicotinoids. And the reason these pesticides are really popular is because they're very insect specific. So there's a certain receptor that is really well characterized in the nervous system. And this receptor is structurally a bit different in invertebrates and invertebrates. And we know that this is a really effective pesticide because it is has very high affinity for the receptor that's in the insect and really low affinity for the receptor that's in the invertebrate. Rather in the vertebrate. So when I was first sort of creating my project and looking into this, I came across a lot of walls because it was like, yes, insect specific, you know, not a concern for mammals, but we also know that this specific pesticide can cause oxidative stress, which is not related to its mechanism of action as a pesticide, but is definitely a mechanism of toxicity, right? And oxidative stress can have a lot of effects, adverse effects at the cellular level that can lead to adverse effects at when it comes to fertility. So I just kind of like to remind people a lot that mechanism of action and mechanism of toxicity can often be unrelated.
No, that's a really good distinction to make, and something that probably, if not explicitly stated, often goes overlooked. So appreciate you bringing that up. To kind of get us towards the end of our conversation here, we really want to leave our audience and our listeners kind of with more of a call to action or on a positive note. We talked about a lot of the ways things can go wrong, right? But we'd love to hear from both of you maybe a few of the things that, since you started researching reproductive toxicology, things that you've changed, changes that you've made in your lifestyle to kind of combat the environment around your microenvironment or environment around you more broadly. And then things that maybe you don't do, or things that are just generally good practice, because some of the dose response of a lot of these chemicals might vary greatly. It might require a lot of something to make a little difference. It might be a little something to make a big difference in good and bad ways in terms of toxins and in terms of things you can do. So we'd love to hear from both of you briefly about those things.
So when we think about some everyday things that we can do that are really simple, I think about opening our windows is actually something that's quite simple. You know, I just, like, every Sunday I will open my windows for a couple hours and then I shut them again. And that's a really good way to kind of get really good airflow in our homes and eliminate our homes from a lot of toxins that actually we live with because they are in our upholstery is a really good example. So like in curtains and couches, there's a lot of chemicals that are there as flame retardants to stop the spread of fires. And we can remove those chemicals from our homes by doing something simple like opening windows. I have tried my best to not use plastic, to not eat out of plastic products. So switching from, you know, Tupperware to like glass food containers is a really good example. Another thing is like when you can and when it's possible to eat organic produce, it's kind of a difficult thing to recommend for me personally, because it's really tied to socioeconomic status. Again, like organic produce isn't really available to everyone. But we do know that organic produce has significantly less pesticides, and many of these pesticides are connected to our fertility. If you can try, there is a list and it's called the Dirty Dozen, and it kind of changes every year. And it's a list of produce that has like a lot of pesticides and like pretty bad pesticides. And so I think it's a really easy way to prioritize, like, if I'm going to go to the grocery store and buy one organic thing, like, you know, what is it going to be today? In my life, it's like always strawberries. I love strawberries and they're pretty much always on the Dirty Dozen. So, yeah, right? Sad. So sad. But those are three things that I would say are sort of straightforward, simple things that I have found fairly easy to incorporate in my everyday life.
Awesome. Thank you. Allison, do you have anything to add on?
I concur about the glassware. I have pretty much gotten rid of all plastics in my home, and it's ridiculous. Like all of my, like the stuff I bring for lunches is just glass. So you can hear me like clanking as I walk down the hall.
That's awesome.
It's heavy too. No, I don't like it. When I first did it, I was like, I don't want to do this. I was like, that's a little heavy and I have to carry it around.
So definitely the glassware. One thing I want to, so I agree with, you know, Vicky's statement about opening windows, because a lot of these chemicals can combine with the dust of our house. And so like house dust actually is really high in a lot of these like flame retardants and things like that. But another thing that you also want to be aware of is, you know, kind of the air quality outside. So just this past summer, we've had a couple of days where, you know, I mean, I wore an N95 mask outside, which felt weird, you know, going from outside to in and taking my mask off, because the air quality was just so bad from the fires up in Canada. And so I think being mindful of that, checking the air quality and, you know, just making sure that, you know, you're protecting yourself when you're outside the house. And unfortunately, if that means, you know, wearing a mask outside, you know, that's a personal choice that you could make. And then I think a big one too is, you know, we use a lot of personal care products in our life, you know, cosmetics, lotions, shampoos, conditioners, soaps, whatever. And so if you can make an effort to choose ones that are paraben free or phthalate free or bisphenol free, fragrance free is actually a very important one, because so phthalates, the plasticizer that that we study in the Flaws lab, are not only used in plastics, but they're also used as kind of a chemical to introduce fragrances into certain products, so that the fragrance doesn't, you know, kind of crash out of the product and it stays incorporated. And so they get really tricky, because they'll call it fragrance and not phthalates, you know, whatever flavor of phthalate. And so choosing options that are fragrance free can definitely help you to reduce your exposure. But
those are all amazing pieces of advice. And that, I think that gives even like the two of us a lot to kind of sit and think about and make personal changes in our lives. We have a lot of plastic Tupperware sitting in our kitchen right now, and it sounds like that might not be the case for much longer. We got married last year, and one of the biggest, you know, one of the first things we added to our registry was the glass Pyrex
for
sets.
Storage. At
for
least.
Storage. So we do store our food in glass, but it looks like we'll have to get more Pyrex soon.
Yeah.
But thank you both so much for being on the show. It was such a pleasure to learn from you both and to meet you both and chat with you. This is such an important topic that I think seems like we have so much work to do in, yet it's so difficult, like such difficult work. And I'm so glad that you both are championing at least, you know, a part of it and kind of moving it forward, because the impact that it will make is only going to continue to grow as we kind of, you know, as our society kind of continues to move in this direction where we're using a lot of products and just, you know, being in such a complex environment where we're making so many decisions for ourselves. You know, we're no longer hunter-gatherers. So I'm sure life was much different in that, you know, in this sense back then. So it is so cool to see, you know, this work being done despite the fact that it seems like it should have been done so long ago, and we're learning so much. But yeah, just thank you both so much.
Yeah, you're
thank
welcome.
You so much.
Great talking with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. It was a pleasure talking with you.
That's all for this month's episode. You can follow us on Instagram at Science in Society to catch our new releases, upcoming topics, and our science shenanigans.
If you're enjoying our show, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts to help more people find Science in Society. Be sure to tune into episode 6, the season finale, coming October 2nd.
Peace, love, and science.